Did you know you could sponsor Dirt and Tie? That's right, for just $20, we'd say something nice about you here. Maybe compliment your shoes, or just, like, talk about that place. We went that one time, and it was really cool and stuff, and then you, like, did that thing, and I said, that was so funny, but it really wasn't funny. It was horrifying. Yeah, we talk about all that. Just $20. Go to nerdandtie.com and click on the sponsor information. Or you can donate to our legal fund by going to gofundme.com/nerdandtie.
On this episode of Nerd and Tie, Trey and Nick went to CoolieCon. We talked to author David Boop about the Savage Worlds reboot of Bureau 13. The big topic is our favorite tabletop stories, the Vomit Has Steve Challenge, and more.
Woohoo!
And I am one third of your hosts this evening. Morning. Noon or night, whenever you listen to this. Again, Proc, with me as always, are the fantastic Trey Dorn.
I exist as a person and everything.
And the amazingly wonderful Nick Izumi.
I'm amazing and wonderful.
Yes. Yes,
indeed. It's true.
It's been a busy month.
Yeah, and you two
it's been nuts.
Just got back from CoolieCon last weekend.
Yeah, it was a week ago. Or a week and a half ago. We're recording a few days later than expected. Ha ha! Schedules. We went down to CoolieCon in La Crosse, Wisconsin, about a week and a half ago. Or sometime in the past, if you're listening to this later than, like, the week that we record it. Like, if it's, like, 2 years from now and you've decided to do an archive dive, because I know there are you... I look at the stats, there are people, like, who do that. So, it's a nice little, gaming convention. I think the estimated attendees was about 800. At least that's the number that they were given to the press. It was fun. It was a fun little con.
It was really fun. I didn't get to stay for the whole weekend, but, I got to hang out with Trey for a little bit. I saw a couple of my old college buddies and some other friends of the show. Shot the chat. It was just a good time.
Yeah, I had a Comicsgate guy show up at our table and explain to me how great Comicsgate was, and I had to resist the urge to punch him in the face.
I was not there for that.
It's okay. He eventually found our website and wrote a really, really mean comment on our Vic Mignogna article. So, thanks for stopping by, Tim. I don't know. I was literally wearing my genderqueer pride flag shirt, and he's telling me how great Comicsgate was, and I'm just like, I understand that, like, the more obscure pride flags aren't necessarily recognizable to people outside of the community. That's actually one of the reasons why I choose to go with it, so I'm not, like, putting myself in danger in small town America, but because most people are accepting, but some people are assholes. I just did it to my face. I just kept arguing with him. Like, I didn't, like, I was polite, I was nice, but, like, and the thing is it's like, I was trying to give this guy the benefit of the doubt because he seemed like a nice guy who was just, like, for some reason really excited about really terrible comics. But then when he posted on our site in the comment field, I was like, oh no, this guy really is an asshole. He's just too afraid to be an asshole in person.
Mm-hmm.
Chicken shit, little.
with support like that, why does Vic Mignogna even need enemies? Like, really?
Well,
his supporters do.
But also, this guy, like, I mean, I'm sorry. I don't think this guy actually watches anime based on, like, he's, like, really defensive of Vic because he's picked a tribe. That whole tribal team just confuses the heck out of me. But for the most part, actually, the convention was really great. Like, I mean, that guy, I mean, pretty much I spent, like, half the time, like, I was talking to another one of the vendors there, and then we were pretty much ripping on this Comicsgate guy for a while.
And I was at a different convention.
Yeah, you were.
Reading, like, I was entertained during a slow period by your tweets about this dude. So
yeah,
I appreciate.
I've become more prolific on Twitter lately. It's it's fun, but I don't know. Overall, so overall, the convention it's a little con. It's at the La Crosse Center, and
I remember when they were on campus there.
Yeah, it's. But the convention is just, you know, it's nice. It's run by the people actually running the event were really nice. Josh was a really nice guy. I only got to talk to him a couple of times. He seemed like a cool dude. And like while there are little nitpicks I could make about lots of like things, like, and there are other people I could make fun of that I'm not going to. I don't mean that as like I just mean like people who did like dick things to other people, like those people, I could harp on that, but none of that was the staff. The staff was great, and the attendees on the whole were pretty nice people. And if you stop by our table and grabbed a sticker or grab flyers for like our stuff, welcome to listening to the show. I promise most of it's not me bitching about things. It just happens time to time.
Mm-hmm.
And Scott,
it was
Logan
really
was
fun.
There.
Yeah, Paper Scott was there. It was a lot of fun.
But yeah, it's, you know, the funny thing is that like a large number of the vendors there were from Eau Claire. That was just funny to me. Like, I traveled, you know, an hour and 45 minutes to sit across from the table for the comic shot that is 5 minutes down the road from me. Like, I literally drive by the place almost every day. That amused me too much. Like, yeah. But it was neat. It was a good event.
I also had a good time. It was a whole lot of fun. It was just a whole lot of fun.
Yeah. I got to meet people whose names I didn't actually completely remember, and so I can't friend them on Facebook. So, other vendor who I talk to a lot during the con, I don't know. But hopefully we'll run into you again at another con. That seems likely. Not a big state. Yeah, that vendor was next to another vendor who I vended next to at a different con, and who I remember him, but I don't remember his name, so I can't friend him either. So it's like, this is the problem, is that I end up like meeting people and befriending them, and I can't remember their names. And so I rely on other people remembering who I am to maintain any sort of connection after an event. I am the worst. I remember the name of the guy who runs my local comic shop, but it's because he runs my local comic shop.
I mean, fair.
Also, he runs Claremont Comics, and his first name is Chris. How am I going to forget that? The store is named after the road in Eau Claire, but it's Chris from Claremont Comics is going to be easy to remember.
For now.
And if you don't know why that should be easy to remember, go read some X-Men issues from, like, the 80s.
I mean, fair.
Yeah.
But you were at the, again, you were at the Geekcraft Expo in Madison. Is that what it was called?
Yes, the Geekcraft Expo. They hold, I don't really want to call it a convention because it's not a full convention. It's basically if you took just the, like, artist alley portion.
Okay.
And, well, like, had a room full of artist alley, and that's it.
So it's a craft fair, only for geeky.
It's stuff. It's a geeky craft fair. And they hold these across the country. They were trying to get people to go vend at their Hawaii event, which
I mean, don't get me wrong, I'd love to go to Hawaii, but if I went to Hawaii, I wouldn't want to vend while I was there.
Yeah.
Fair.
And, yeah, but the staff were absolutely lovely. It was a little bit different, a little bit, because it's right downtown Madison. It's only Saturday, Sunday. It was like free or like, I think at most like $2 or $3 to get in. So you get a lot of people, a lot of families coming in, a lot of people who don't normally go to like full anime conventions.
How much is the table?
Table was spendy.
So it's more like the Comic-Con model of conventions where you do a high table cost but a low attendee cost on the hopes that the attendees then have more money to spend.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like I was able to make my table back, which is great.
That's good.
And I was able to stay with friends, so my expenses were really low. But yeah, it's a bit much to like get into. I was very hesitant at first. But you know, I've had other friends sell there in the past and they were like, no, this has good sales. Like you should do this. You should up your prices and do this. But it is much less anime fan stuff.
Well, it's, you know, it's when
I'm okay with that.
Yeah, when I first heard about it, I was like my first thought was craft shows because I've been to craft fairs and craft shows. Because I mean, like the first time I went to one, it was kind of amused me because I was like, this is like an artist alley, only it's old ladies with sweaters.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just this one is it's way more general geeky stuff.
Well, I think you would get a lot of the people who do like the science fiction conventions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just a little bit different than, you know, what I normally do. And so like sales were a little bit different than normal. Like at anime conventions, buttons go over really, really well.
Well, this is
I don't know what it is.
Yeah, that. Well, it's because buttons are inexpensive and anime fans are young and broke.
Mm-hmm.
True.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's.
Whereas, like at this one, I didn't hardly sell any buttons, which is okay. I sold other stuff, but it was just kind of weird.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's neat. We all had fun that weekend.
Yeah. It was a good weekend.
So it's I recommend the so you. I think it's safe to say you recommend that event again for people to attend. If they're looking
I
for
would, but just warning people about like the table cost is pretty high.
Oh yeah, I wasn't necessarily saying recommend it to vend at, but to attend as like an attendee.
Oh, to attend for sure. Okay. Super cheap, like tons of great stuff. They curate. They curate the tables to make sure that like not a lot of people have the same stuff. So okay. if there's somebody doing like soap and bath bombs, there's gonna be like one other table doing that. There's not gonna be like five or six. So you're gonna find a large variety of stuff being sold at them, which is really neat.
It is neat. Yeah. I think, and I will say, if you're looking for a small, really fun gaming convention, CooliCon is a great way to go. I have a love for small cons. They're what I actually prefer going to. Lord help me when YumaCon comes around. I like smaller cons, and I think it's a really fun, intimate experience, and yeah.
Oh, I forgot to mention the other nice thing about CooliCon. Some of my friends who I ran into were former staffers at summer camp with me, and so I got to help them teach card games to some little kids, and that was
awesome.
Really cool. Yeah, it was. I love passing on geekdom to the next generation.
You know, speaking of passing on geekdom to new generations and previous things that are new things, and this is a transition that'll work. Trust me.
Do it.
Do it.
Nick and I, and we're going to do a little time travel right now because we recorded this before the show because of, you know, time and availability. We sat down with author David Boop about the Savage Worlds reboot of a classic TriTac game, Bureau 13. And in a moment, you'll hear me do part of that intro again with a lot more information as we travel through time. Joining us on the podcast now is David Boop, who has, by the way, my favorite last name. David Boop is the USA Today best-selling editor of Straight Outta Tombstone and is hoping for the same success with Straight Outta Deadwood and Straight Outta Dodge City coming out from Bayon in October and February, respectively. He's the author of She Murdered Me with Science, a sci-fi noir out now from Worldfire Press, and its prequel, A Whisper to a Scheme. He's also a Scribe-nominated media tie-in author, having worked with Predator, Green Hornet, and Veronica Mars. And if that wasn't enough, he's a game designer currently adapting the classic RPG Bureau 13, Stalking the Night Fantastic, to the Savage Worlds system. And that's what we're talking about today. Welcome
Thank
to
you.
The show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So Bureau 13, Stalking the Night Fantastic, for our listeners who might not be aware, is a classic Tri-Tac game that first came out in 1983.
For the listeners my age, basically.
yeah. And for the millennials in the audience and Gen Z who weren't browsing crudely photocopied games at Gen Con 20 years ago. The Bureau 13, Stalking the Night, it's effectively the X-Files before the X-Files happened.
Indeed. In fact, it's before anything like that happened, before Ghostbusters, before Men in Black, before X-Files. Richard Tolka, who was the creator of it, was sort of a visionary. He also co-wrote the Morrow Project, which is still very successful in its fifth or 20th edition. I don't even know. But Morrow Project, which was a great game. And also Fringeworthy, which arguably... depending on who you talk to, was the basis of Stargate. And
I always thought Fringeworthy was closer to Sliders, but that's just me.
Well, you know, there and there's definitely room to discuss that too. But I do know that there were some legal proceedings involving Stargate. But that is not my story to tell. but what I can tell you is that Richard was absolutely a pioneer in the industry. He came up with ideas and concepts that that nobody was looking at the time. When we look at what was out when Bureau 13 first was released, there were no like true horror games at that point. There was, you know, we have Ravenloft. And that's about it. And he came up with this idea of mixing horror and comedy shortly after he did this. Oh, I think we also have Call of Cthulhu had come out shortly before Bureau 13. So we have Ravenloft, we have Call of Cthulhu. But those were both very, very serious, very dark. And Richard... he had this philosophy of looking at the world through what we hunt, you know, and so he takes like the kind of the Kolchak, the Night Stalker philosophy, where there's a certain amount of humor, a certain amount of satire, and a certain amount of horror, and he blends it together in Bureau 13. And again, this was before anybody else was doing this. The idea of the government hunting down and containing supernatural and paranormal monsters, it's truly revolutionary in the industry,
I'd say. And it's so ubiquitous in fiction these days, it's kind of hard to imagine there was a point without it. But like, that's such a cool concept.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And it has become a standard trope. You know, it's right up there with urban fantasy and you know, epic fantasy. And, you know, we see shades of it when you look through the original book, and eventually when you guys look through what we're doing, you can see shades in that original book, and especially the 92 edition, or 92, 83 and 92, the 92 edition that has the Phil Folio cover. When you when you read through that, you go, oh my God, I just saw an episode of Supernatural that addressed this exact same thing. Or,
I mean, to be fair, Supernatural has been running long enough where I'm pretty sure they've covered every single Supernatural
correct.
Fantasy concept at this point.
Uh-huh. Correct. But you see it also in like Warehouse 13, mm-hmm. Grimm, the very short-lived Ghosted TV series that was on Fox last year, which actually made a Bureau 13 reference. Subtly, because I don't think they looked to see who had the rights, but they made a very, very subtle reference to Bureau 13 in one episode where they're going to have to blow up the base and sacrifice everybody inside. And they say, is this a B-13 situation? And they're like, yes, this is totally a B-13 situation. And I'm going, oh, come on. Are you kidding me?
I adored that show. That just made me more sad that it didn't last longer. Like,
it definitely got more of its wind in the second half of the season, which unfortunately is also what happened to The Middleman, which is based on a...
So great.
Oh, it was. It was totally great. And completely Bureau 13, a little more slapstick than Bureau 13, not as much of the satire. Ghosted definitely had more satire, but The Middleman picked up steam about halfway through the season as well. But of course, in today's market, people don't invest in whole seasons if they don't catch it within the first six episodes, or most times first one to three.
Yeah,
it's gone. It's history, and it's out of their mind. There are too many other things competing with it.
Yeah. Mm. So there have been a number of editions, obviously, of Bureau 13 over the years, mm-hmm. including a D20 modern adaptation about 10 years ago. What made you guys want to adapt this to Savage Worlds?
Mm. So I got to meet Richard shortly before his death. He was running the dealer's room at a small con that at that time was called the Conclave in Detroit.
Okay.
Shortly after that, it became Continuum. Now it's called Fiasco Con, and I don't know what it's going to be next year. I met him. He was running the dealer's room. He had a Tritech booth there. And I was having I'm an author, you know, as you described. And so I was going to Detroit to do a con, and I had a booth. And so I talked to him about getting the booth. And when I found out who he was, we had this wonderful conversation on the phone where I totally fanboyed. And then so when we met in person, there was just this instant rapport. And he's such a great guy. If you've never had a chance to meet him, you just, there was something different in your life.
I don't know. What I just learned is that I've been mispronouncing his last name for 20 years.
Oh, Tolka?
Yeah.
So during the course of the convention, we talked a lot about Bureau 13, and I'm always looking for new media tie-ins to work in. And previously, Nick Pallotta did a series of Bureau 13 novels. And of course, as you mentioned, there had been other adaptations of Bureau 13, which I had not known about. I had only known about the 92 with the folio cover. And so when we were talking, he was like, well, I would love to do a new novel, and I'd like to go back to the beginning. I'd like to go back to that 92 edition and bring the humor back, bring the satire back.
Mm-hmm.
Because what had happened is, of course, in the years when we have X-Files and all of these, you know, more and more serious. I mean, Monster Hunter International by Larry Correa, you know, it's got the humor, it's got the action. But it also has a lot of BFGs, and blowing up things is a lot of fun in those books, and it's part of what makes Monster Hunter great. But he's like, he goes, you know, one of the things in the original books was you got points for not blowing up things. You got more experience points for figuring out a way to resolve the situation without ending up in combat. And he goes, I would love to get back to that kind of idea of the every man or every person dealing with these extreme paranormal events, which, of course, is a big thing for me. I love that story. I love the idea of everyday person suddenly, you know, walking through a wardrobe into Narnia type of stuff, you know. And so we talked, and it, over the course of the conversation, he's like, yeah, I want you to write a book for me. Get me an outline, send it to me, which I wrote an outline and I sent it to him. I didn't hear anything back. And it was a couple months later, I heard from Mel Natcher, his widow, that that he had passed. And she was still, she read the outline, said, yeah, no, we love this. We'd like to go forward with the book. So so I met her at the next year's, it had gone from Conclave to Continuum at that point. So I met her at the next year's Continuum, and we talked, and I met with her, and we discussed the future of Bureau 13. And from that conversation, because I had worked on three other Savage Worlds properties, I had written an adventure for Deadlands Noir. I had written a serialized novel for Ripper's Resurrected, and I had just finished working on Flash Gordon, one of the worlds of Mongo for Flash Gordon. And it's like, well, let's take it to Pinnacle and see if they're interested in adapting Bureau 13. Well, this was right before, like literally minutes before they announced Suede, the Savage Worlds Adventurers edition, which, you know, is the newest edition of Savage Worlds. And he's like, there's no way we can take on this project right now. And he goes, but, we'll support you, as we do a lot of our third-party vendors. We'll support you along the way if you want to do it. He goes, you're in Denver, where some of the absolute best Savage Worlds, most dedicated fans of Savage Worlds are. So I'm going to give a shout out to the Rocky Mountain Savages right now. You guys rock. In fact, they're so dedicated. They're putting on a Savage Worlds cruise next year. Wow. So if you want to spend a week at sea playing Savage Worlds with pretty much everybody involved with Savage Worlds, it is definitely something to look up. But anyway, so I started putting together a team of people who had worked on other Savage Worlds projects. And I put together this amazing team led by Dustin Hatchett, who's my project manager, who has seen me through some really hard stuff. His and I's vision for the book have been just great. If you go to our Savage the Night Fantastic website and see our jumpstart, you get kind of a sample of what we're planning to do, which is to make it look like a redacted government document. I mean, you know,
very cool.
You gotta be careful, especially considering Bureau 13's history with replicating government documents.
we've done a pretty good job. We've had some amazing people doing our layout. Guy Davis and Carl Kiesler have both come in to work on our layout and design. And the stuff you're going to see in there is just going to be incredible. I can't even begin to tell you.
Yeah, it's for those of you who don't know, there's kind of a famous story about Tri-Tac Games getting raided by the FBI for producing identification papers that look too similar to real government IDs.
One of the things we're doing is, the idea, the conceit within Bureau 13 is in 1977, the Bureau, which had been like right on par with the FBI before that, was betrayed and destroyed. Many agents were killed. Only a few survived. And so the Bureau goes underground and it starts recruiting everyday people who have experienced some sort of paranormal event. That way they can keep evil off of its guard, because there's no one central location really for the Bureau. And they don't know who the agents are, because they could be everyday people. It could be anybody. It can be a truck driver, or a housewife, or, you know, a high school student or whatever. And so, and this worked really, really well for the Bureau and builds the funny into the story. Well, when I took on the project, you know, since Richard wanted to go back to the 92 edition, we've skipped over all of the other versions. And we're actually saying, okay, from 92 to 2019, what has happened? And we looked at history, and the government balanced the budget in like 98. And one of the things that happened was the Bureau got defunded for all intents and purposes. It's still there, but it is a little skeleton of itself. And so so when these new agents are coming in, they're finding they don't have access to necessarily the resources that they used to have. So going back to your thing about documents, yeah, we've got government documents that look like they're 20 and 30 years old. We're using things like fax, you know, things that look like old faxes and old green bar paper and post-it notes and, you know, that are and with coffee stains on them, you know, Polaroid photographs and all the equipment. They're driving around in a an old GMC motorhome. That's our Millennium Falcon. It is basically stuck together with duct tape and so forth. And so everything that these 2019, 2020 players are going to have from the Bureau, it's going to be dated. But then we're also building in the idea that the resources you have on you are resources you can use. So, you know, making use of things like online supernatural wikis, you know, and your cell phones. One of our favorite monsters is, you know, how genies are normally trapped in like a bottle or a lamp. Mm-hmm. Well, we have genies that are trapped in cell phones, and and so it's kind of a gin PS where the genie to try and annoy you to the point of letting him or her free does things like you're on your way to a new date, like your first date with a new girlfriend, but the GPS takes you on a route that drives you past your ex-girlfriend's house repeatedly and then dials her and lets her know that you're passing by. So she ends up calling the cops, saying that her ex-boyfriend is stalking her. So they're mischievous like that. Important meeting downtown. Hey, wait, why am I parked in front of the beach? How did I get here? I just followed the GPS. And it's because the genie thought you would have more fun at the beach than landing that really big deal. So we're making use, we're evolving the creatures that have now been overdone. We don't have just regular vampires and regular werewolves and regular zombies. Everything is an evolution of those characters. And there's a meta story behind it of why this is happening. But you're not going to find the classic monsters in here because you can go to any Savage Worlds book, ETU or the Horror Companion or of course, the Suede book itself, and you can find those classic monsters. You want to fight just vampires? Hey, heck, you can fight vampires. You can pull the stats from that from anywhere. But in our book, we have shadow vampires, which are actually two-dimensional vampires that have been like basically grafted onto walls. And so, you know, we've taken that. We have a random wear table with 666 different wear creatures you can become, including a wear tsetse fly. We have Chihuahua cabras. So we've taken the world that exists now and said, how would the monsters of the past interact with today? Sobek, the Egyptian god of the Nile, who's basically a giant crocodile, right? Mm-hmm. He got so tired of 500 years of heroes showing up to destroy his plans and always saying the same thing. You're going to look nice as a pair of boots, right? And he's like, if I hear one more leather boot joke, crocodile boot joke, So he gets out of the evil business, per se, and opens up a chain of coffee shops called Star Falls Coffee. And and basically tailors to the paranormal creatures out there who are just looking for a sobachino before going into work.
All right. Well, neat. I would be remiss if I didn't bring up the fact that you guys are doing a Kickstarter.
Thank you. Yes, actually, Friday the 13th in September, September 13th, our Kickstarter launches. And oh my God, do we have some great stuff. We've been sending out press releases fairly regularly. And the one we just sent out yesterday announced that one of the things we're going to have in our Kickstarter is D13 dice. D as in David, 13 dice. And these dice, we have D13 tables, such as like random demon duck mutation table. We're adapting things like the Savage Words Fear table to a D13 table so that there's something unique about this system. But once you hit our full level, the backer level, which is called the 1997 Agent Memorial edition, you will get a D13 in there. We also have adaptations for things like D12s and D20s in case you don't want to get a D13. But who doesn't want a D13, really?
I was gonna say, I've never seen a D13 in my life.
Oh, they're
imagine it.
So here's the thing. It's really cool. The 7 is smaller than the other facets. So it never can land on it can't land on a way to show the opposite side of the 7, which is the 14. So it's actually a 14-sided die, but it will never the 14 is blank. And it will land on the 14 showing the 7, but it can never land on the 7 showing the blank. That's how they do it. It's ingenious. But we're going to have them, and they're going to be awesome. Another thing we announced yesterday that's going to be part of the Kickstarter is we're bringing back original Bureau 13 writers, Lawrence Watt Evans and Mercedes Lackey. Wow. Both who wrote for Richard stories that got adapted into adventures for Bureau 13, and we're getting new stories set in the new agency, but they're going to be potentially going to be bringing back some of their original characters, and that will be a stretch goal called Original Bureau 13 Authors Return. So.
Nice.
So yeah, we if you haven't seen Phil Folio's new cover, where, you know, we basically said, hey Phil, okay, so this was you in 92, how would you do that today? And he just nailed it out of the park. It is amazing. It's a full spread wraparound cover of the Star Falls Coffee, and it's got the same elements of the original book. But it's, you know, now the agents are busting into this coffee shop, surprising the monsters, as opposed to the dungeon looking one of the original, which is very contemporary. And you'll see that we've also, you know, tapped into the idea that the gamers today are a little bit different than necessarily gamers 30 and 20 years ago. So it's a beautiful thing, and we're going to have lithographs of that cover available as backer rewards as well. So we've got a lot of really cool things, and we're going to be announcing more and more as we get closer to the date, which is really only a couple of weeks away.
Yeah.
Which is just insane. So that's where we're at with that.
All right. Well, that is freaking awesome. That's about the time we have for this. So thank you so much for coming on the show, David. And,
thank you for having me.
And we'll link to in the show notes stuff mm-hmm. about this so people can, you know, follow up on their own
mm-hmm.
and, Yeah, is
just
there...
just remember hashtag Savage the Night Fantastic is the quickest way to get to all of our information. A link to the Kickstarter is there. The Jumpstart preview is there for downloading. Comes with an adaptation of the original Bureau 13 game thing from Walnut Creek. Oh yeah, let me throw this in real quick. Go to YouTube and look up Bureau 13 Longshot Productions. Bureau 13 Longshot Productions, my company. You will find a 10-minute mini movie, animated mini movie, of a thing from Walnut Creek. So if you like, you want to see kind of how we see the agency these days, go check it out. I think you'll enjoy it, and you might recognize some of the characters in there.
All right.
Oh wow.
Thank you. Thanks so much for coming on, David.
Oh no, thank you for having me. And we've got to hang at a con sometime, Trey. It's been too long, man.
It has. And with that, we'll travel back in time to the present, which is also your past. Listening to this, and Gen will rejoin us now. Apparently. Something. I'll come up with a fancy transition here. Whoa. Oh boy. That sure was a thing that already happened.
Real talk, I love that interview because it was comedy, it was gaming, and it was references to canceled TV shows. You could not have gotten a more Nerd and Tie interview than that.
Yeah, no. I'm really excited about the reboot of Bureau 13, and it's I think it's going to be really neat, especially with all the people involved. But because we did that interview last week, I don't remember enough of the specifics right now to really comment into more detail than that.
I wrote down that thing that I was going to say after the bit specifically so I could do it right there, and then I ruined it just now by explaining that.
Yeah, and we will make sure that we have links and stuff in the show notes for people who go to nerdandtie.com, and it should be in the description on iTunes and stuff in your podcatcher. So it's in the feed, so you should be able to go do that. But again, you want to take us into our big topic?
Big topic! We're going to talk about our favorite tabletop game stories.
Because there's a theme for this episode.
Hey, yo. Would you like me to kick it off with the story, or do you want?
I don't know. It's we were talking about tabletop RPGs. I mean, pretty much everyone's got a story at some point. Like, I've been playing, you know, role playing games for over. I'm 38. I've been playing since I was like 14. So. I don't feel like thinking about the math there for how long I've been playing.
A long ass time.
I mean, I've designed not one but two different role-playing systems, one of which I will let people in the public see, and we have a whole podcast using it, but there's a predecessor to that that has been buried, and no one will ever find it. No one. But... So, yeah, it's pretty much most of us have good stories if we've been playing for a while. I think, if actually, you know, just in Stormwood, we've had some interesting experiences. Like, I'm going to reveal... So, if you haven't listened to episode 19 of Stormwood and Associates, you might want to plug your ears for a moment. No, I just won't be specific, but there is kind of a major event in episode 19 of Stormwood and Associates. And as I was GMing that, that was not supposed to happen. That massive emotional event was not supposed to happen. I had plans in the main arc to deal with this, and I have new plans. They'll be fine. But those attacks were based, like, who was being attacked was based on kind of a roll of a dice, and. I will say, there was someone who was supposed to die in that fight who lived, and there was someone who was supposed to live in that fight who died. And
I will say that was a very hard bit for me personally, because it involved me having to play very dramatically a character who I wrote as a comedy character.
Well, I think that's the best drama comes from characters who are meant to be comedic. It's when you find that. but that is like so NPC deaths.
And that's
though,
why Pat Labor 2 is the best Pat Labor entry.
The movies are mediocre.
Sorry.
They're well animated, but they're mediocre compared to the OVAs. Anyways, but unexpected NPC deaths are like, especially when you had plans for them, are kind of one of the more interesting things. When I was in high school, I played a lot of Vampire the Masquerade, the White Wolf, the first version of it. They later rebooted the whole World of Darkness series, which I've never played the later versions of it. But I played the original Vampire the Masquerade, you know, back when Gangrel was a clan. We were playing this campaign, and one of the other players, this guy Jake, had this NPC was his character's, like, kind of his servant who, like, follows around. I remember the character's name was Ox. And our characters got into a gunfight because, sure, that's keeping up the masquerade and hiding vampires from the world. Just get into gunfights in public. Anyways, we were in high school. We were dumb. So this NPC, Ox, was like, Jake just apparently had very strong connection to this NPC, and Ox, who was a human, died in that fight. He died in that fight. And so the GM was this guy, Greg, and Greg's kind of a dick, still is to this day, but he was like, Ox is dead. And like, he wasn't being that mean, but he was kind of smiling a little. The other thing you have to know is that Jake is not a tall guy. Jake is like 5'4". And he was 5'4", but he was also an athlete. He was a tiny ball of rage. Jake, just like, when Ox died, Jake sat in his chair, put his face in his hands for a moment. And so there's about four or five of us in the room. I don't remember who all was playing in this campaign. It just went silent for a moment, and we're all just kind of waiting for him to do something. At that point, he leapt out of the chair and tried to strangle our GM.
Oh, jeez.
And started screaming, "You son of a bitch, you killed Ox." And, like, two or three of us had to pull him off. And Jake, again, is a tiny guy. So, like, it is just, no, it was the most hilarious, like, memorable moment to me in all of my gaming experiences, the time that one of the players attempted to murder our GM.
When I think back to, like, my high school role-playing days, there's one session, and I'm really sad we didn't meet for another one. We did, we decided to try out. I had the one guy who always was our DM. He and his dad would go to, like, small gaming shows, and they would buy lots of, like, games for pretty cheap. And we would test them out, like, mostly games from the 80s and stuff. Well, we decided to try out the D6-based Star Trek role-playing game, which I had a good time with. I'm going to be honest, I had a lot of fun. I was the helmsman. We were on a Miranda-class ship. It was a lot of fun. We had an encounter with the Romulans. But the thing that I haven't gotten over, because this is,
Tamalak.
So I'm really sad we didn't have more than one session, because it was actually a really fun game, and we had an interesting mishmash of a crew. But our security officer was played by the one person in our friend group who was politically conservative. Like, the one conservative in our group was the security officer, which wasn't the weird part. The weird part was that he chose to play a Ferengi. And I haven't gotten over how this guy, who was always obsessed with, like, even in high school, with, you know, we have to keep taxes down, and I don't like you, and I don't like how liberals spend money, like, played Ferengi completely straight, like with no self-awareness, and it was absolutely amazing. Like, and he played this Ferengi in a as so money grubbing that season one Quark would be embarrassed.
Mm-hmm.
It was freaking amazing. So that was, yeah, that's one of my earliest role playing memories. Oh, high school was good.
Yeah.
Okay.
My first role playing memory started before I even got to play D&D. See, my dad's a big nerd, and he had Baldur's Gate on the PC. And so when I was real little, my sister and I would play Baldur's Gate. And of course I was terrible and I would constantly die. And so the first part of that game is embedded into my brain just because I played it so much, because I kept dying. It was not great. But the first NPC that you meet is your childhood best friend. She's a half-elven rogue named Imowen. And so, you know, having played this and, like, I understand the world.
Yeah, because Baldur's Gate.
That general world. Yeah.
Baldur's Gate's set in Forgotten Realms, D&D setting.
Exactly. So when I was 10, my dad took my sister and I to our first D&D game with his friends. And this was version 2. So there were no books. we had a notebook. And you just wrote down your character sheet in your notebook. And I think I still have mine somewhere. It's got a sticker in it.
Yeah, the photocopied character sheets really didn't become common until like the end of the 90s and then the early 2000s. Like the vampire, like the World of Darkness stuff all had character sheets you would photocopy because it used filled in dots. But like when we played Second Ed, we just always just wrote out our whole character sheet on line notebook paper.
Yep, yep. And, like, of course, I'm 10 years old, trying to be a smartass. So I'm creating my character. I really love it. She's great. I'm so excited to play her. And the DM was like, okay, who's your character? And I'm like, I'm playing a half-elven range, or a half-elven rogue named Imowen. And I tried to spell out the name for him, and he's like, kid, I know how to spell that name. I introduced your dad to Baldur's Gate.
Oh, no.
And I'm just like, cool. I was a dumb 10-year-old. I don't have much memory of the actual game. I just remember that we played, it was his friend's basement, and they had ferrets. So there's this big cage over in the corner with these two ferrets. They constantly like rattled around because they were all slinky dinky and having fun while we were having fun.
I don't know. My first game I ever played of D&D was I was in Boy Scouts and it was like a camping trip. And that's one of the older guys said, like, so yeah, I must have been younger than 14. Had brought like the Second Ed manuals. This is early 90s, and that was the first time I ever played, and the funny thing about it is that, like, so I just remember this one puzzle, because there's a party of adventurers in the dungeon, not really all that creative, you know, campaign. It was just real basic. We were exploring a dungeon looking for something. I don't even remember, but we came to this door, this wooden door with a metal skull on it and no obvious handles. And this was my first time playing, so I was sitting back for a little while during this part. And like one of the characters tried to cast something on the door, didn't do anything. One of them tried to touch the skull because they immediately went to the skull, the metal skull in the center of the door, and it burned them. And so they're contemplating like all of this stuff, like they're, like, poking at the metal skull, like, it's hurting them. They're trying to dispel it. They're trying to do all this stuff. And I just remember that since the holes in the skull, like you can see with, there was just a relief of a skull on the door, I joked, I poked the skull in the eye. And she goes, the door moves. I push on the door opens. It's the most amusing puzzle to me that has ever been in any, like, in any campaign. And that's why it stuck with me since the beginning, that this door had a cursed skull on it, but was not locked. And that skull had nothing to do with the opening mechanism of the door. And, like, this group of, like, it was like six other players who were all experienced players who had all played before. And this is my first session ever. I'm playing a borrowed character. And I just pushed on the door. Like, no one had ever thought, push on the door. And so it's that kind of puzzle that, like, kind of inspired me in the way I designed things, that, like, give them the obvious misdirect and just watch what happens. Like, I'm not one of those people who, like, some people when they GM will be like, they won't really have a solution for their puzzle. They'll just wait and see what the players try, and if it's interesting enough, they'll let it work. No, I'm not a fan of that. I think of the mechanism, and I will let players solve it any way possible. But, not to immediately go into a second story, but that actually reminds me of, when I was in college, we were playing a campaign of a Returners FFRPG, which is a fan-made Final Fantasy-based role-playing game. I was playing with a group of other people. One of the other people playing was Kyle Johnson, who's on Stormwood and Associates with us. And it was this... this campaign was based on The Dark Tower. I've never read The Dark Tower, so oftentimes I had no idea which was coming just out of the Final Fantasy parts of the campaign and which parts weren't. But I was playing this character, Ilyena, and the fun part about Ilyena is Ilyena doesn't talk. All of my communication was through facial expressions and, like, gestures. The secret is also she's not very smart. She had really low intelligence scores, but no one ever realized that because she didn't talk. And so the way you play Ilyena is whatever's in front of you is the only thing that exists. She doesn't have, like... I pretty much just, like... I was like, I'll just play a character without object permanence. That's, And so our GM had, like... Our GM, Matt White, he had planned out this elaborate thing where we were in this robot city, and I forget what it was called. It was a city populated by robots, and we had gotten trapped in it, and... he had planned for us to be in this place for weeks. But what happened was that I found what I believed to be a way out, and it was this door that opened, but it opened like 100 feet up. And there was like this monorail, like a single rail leaving it. And he was telling me this like he thought that we were going to just immediately like, go, okay, this won't work because we've only got 50 feet of rope. It's 100 feet down. Like, it's this, there's no way. Except he was dealing with me. So the first thing I asked him was, how far out is the first support? He said, I think it was 100 yards. And I was like, okay. 100 yards or 100 feet. Something. It was like not short, but not like an impossible distance. And I was like, okay, is the support like a single pole or is it trestled? He said it was trestled. So I said, okay, I'm going to tie my rope around my waist, loop it around the track, shimmy my way out to the support trestle and climb down. The expression on his face was great. Because he just supplied me all the information I needed, and then he said, he made me make some rolls, and I just cruised through them, and then suddenly the rest of the party had to follow me. Now, I had a, my character, because Returns of RPG, I had a mountain chocobo, but we, like, the chocobo made the climb on its rolls, so it was fine. But then Kyle's character had this wolf. And they were like, he was like, it's going to be really hard for that wolf, to, like, for them to, like, transport the wolf this way. And I was like, I don't care. My character doesn't like Kyle's character. I don't care if what happens to the wolf. I didn't, my character didn't like that character since they showed up. I mean, you have to understand, Kyle is like one of my closest friends from college. So it's like, I like Kyle. Ileana didn't like his character. So, but the wolf made the rolls barely and everyone's fine. But like it was, I spoiled weeks of planning. Like he had detailed notes ready for this place. And I ruined it single-handedly.
Jeez. So when it comes to one of my favorite stories, some of my favorite stories of the role-playing usually come more from other dumb crap that people around me do. Kind of building off of what you were saying earlier, Trey, something that I think is fascinating is that I think a good DM or GM or whatever you want to call it, the best way to do it is to not have the story you want to do set too much in stone, because as soon as the party goes off the track, either all your plans get thrown out or you have to try to force them to railroad back onto what your planned path for them, and then the players aren't having as much fun. Well, one of my favorite examples of this was I was playing Dungeons and Dragons while I was working at a Boy Scout camp. And one of the younger staffers created this absolute edgelord character. And edgelord guy comes in. And, like, we get some basic setup before we start the game. It's like, all right, this is the world that we live in. This is what you do. The religion in our world is simple. We're going to simplify the gods from the books. There's one god is good, one is evil. And this guy initially, like, picks the evil god and is like, yes, I worship this one. He's like, also, I hunt undead. And the GM is like, but undead are evil, so they're servants of the thing you worship. Never mind, sorry. So we already have this awkward edgelord guy, our DM loved the guy to death, but he was relentless on us. He was the kind of guy who, when he would pick monsters for our encounters, he would pick something 1 to 2 levels higher than us, with the thought process of, I want violence to matter. So when you're fighting, I want you to actually fight for your life. This was his thought. Well, he also had this philosophy for when certain characters wanted to show off. So at one point, our edgelord, I don't remember the character's name, but he was played by a guy named John.
I believe his name was Lord Edge.
We'll call him Lord Edge. We meet Lord Edge at the required pub where you meet your player characters, right? So Lord Edge comes in and he's like, I want to show people that I'm not to be messed with. He's like, I want to like just kind of whip my cape a little bit and people can see my sword underneath. And my GM is like, okay, well, you're going to have to like roll for like a flourish, and he rolls and he gets like a 1, so he like tries to show that he has a sword and then he just pulls it out and just falls down on the bar. And while trying to regain his cool, he starts asking people at the bar if they've seen any undead around, which is just freaking out the villagers, of course. Anyway, this character, Lord Edge, didn't last too long. Not that long later. I haven't gotten over how great this is. not that much later, Lord Edge decided when we were on some quest looking for Weapons of Legacy for the main story, right? And we were actually in the cave looking for the weapon that we didn't know at the time was meant for Lord Edge. And it was being guarded by a massive red dragon.
Of course.
And so there's this massive red dragon. And, you know, we at this point, we've fought vivisectors and all sorts of other nasty stuff. We're used to how nasty these fights get. And Lord Edge is like, wait, I speak dragon. I'm going to try to talk to him.
He's going to try to speak draconic to the thing? Oh, my God.
So he says, he walks out in front of the red dragon and says, what is your name? And the red dragon said, my name is your doom, and immediately used his breath weapon, and Lord Edge was incinerated.
Oh my gosh.
And poor John had to make a new character.
Jeez.
And we beat the dragon and got this useless weapon of legacy that it would not have been useful to anyone else in our party, so we ended up selling it.
Oh my god.
Oh, that was good. It was really good. So, that was the tale of Lord Edge.
Great.
Well, so one of the, like, it's hard to judge what, so you talked about, like, GMs and, like, whether or not, like, railroading it versus, like, letting things naturally develop. I used to run in the system that shall not be spoken of by name that predated Super Awesome Action Heroes that it borrows elements from. I used to run fantasy campaigns in it. I have a persistent world set up with a lot of different stuff. Right, but it was mostly just that I had a map of the whole continent, and I had names of certain cities, and I only really had figured out about what half of the cities were like. But I'd kind of developed, like, to introduce people and saying kind of my own version of modules, like, where I had, like, I ran a couple of different campaigns that were, like, the same campaigns with different players. Just because, you know, if you've got five people you've never, you know, if you've got 3 to 4 people you've never played with before, they've never played that campaign, so you may as well, you know, toss it out if you need a quick game. And one of my quick games was one that I called Mercenaries of Rezel, because Rezel was the name of one of the towns in the fantasy world. Well, the setup of the game, and I had run this successfully once before, so I was expecting things to go pretty smoothly, right? Like, this was my second or third time running a version of this campaign. And the setup was that your group of characters were a team of mercenaries. Like, it's one of the easiest ways to set up fresh characters that you just work together, and that's why you know each other. But the premise is that they are hired by one crime lord to steal something, to steal back an item from another crime lord in the city. But in the setup, I always had it where the guy hiring you, right after you got hired and paid, would get killed by the opposite family, just to immediately start out with combat and danger, and also to keep them from backing out, in theory. So, the first time I ran that campaign went great. Guys took the job, guys did the job, everything worked out. So, it was either the second or third time I ran this, though, that I had a group of players who suddenly the guy got killed after they'd just being handed the money, and they were like, oh crap, we've got to get out of town. They were not supposed to get out of town. I had no plans for anything outside of town. I mean, I had a map. I had a map of the world, thankfully, because, like, I ran other stuff in this world, so, like, I had a persistent, like, concept of what the general world was like. But then they were like, okay, we got to get out of town. I was like, okay. And then they okay, which roads lead out of town? Okay. And then they picked the one that went to the area of the map I had never run any campaigns in before. So suddenly, I've got this group of four players on the run, running out of the city in a campaign that was supposed to never leave the city.
Ah, jeez.
And they are on the run. I've got stacks of NPCs, plans, maps, all useless. And they are running to a part of the world that I have never mapped out before, other than, like, that city's elven. I don't know anything else about it. And so suddenly, I have to, like, I'm like, I've never built the elven culture of this world up all that much. All the campaigns I'm running were either in the dwarven or human areas. Crap. And so I had to, like, as they arrived in places, I had to come up with the lore. And what I did was I, you know, the campaign then changed. Rather than railroading the characters, it was suddenly, okay, they took the money from this crime family to do a job and ran. What would happen? And so some NPCs got new names and slight background tweaks, but suddenly all the guys that they were going to go fight became renamed and part of the other family, and they're all the guys who were coming hunting for them because they took the money. Because they sent a guy to hire you, and he was dead in the bar, and you took the money. So, of course, they're going to blame you for the job. And so it was such a, like, but I had to completely rewrite the entire thing. And it's just funny because it was a campaign I was running because it was like, okay, I just want to run something quick that I don't have to build anything. I've got everything already put together for this. No, no, just whole notebook worth of stuff. Not even useful. It's, yeah, because they ran away.
So, one of the things I was most proud of, I feel bad because since I moved, I haven't had my RP group hasn't gotten together, but I was running a Macross campaign using the out of print Palladium Robotech role playing books from the 80s.
So, and not like, BattleTech.
Not Battle. No, no. The actual licensed Robotech. Hey, however, there's some really funny stuff in those books that I guess is tangentially related, so I'll mention it. One, Kevin Simbita, the editor from Palladium Games and author of most of the early Robotech books, has some insanely, like, racist toward the Zentradi, like, things throughout all of his roleplay books, and I'm just kind of like, why do you hate these fictional aliens so much? Two, there is some really great, and I mean primo, propaganda that was definitely thrown in there by Harmony Gold, decrying anyone who bought the English-dubbed tape that was in distribution at the time of the original Macross movie, Do You Remember Love? Because that tape was in circulation here in the U.S. in the 80s. I have a copy of that VHS. And there is a bit where the people from Harmony Gold decry the existence of that tape and anyone who watches it, which is hilarious. I should have gotten that out before I started this little rant. Oh, well. But anyway, I was running this Macross RP, having a lot of fun with it, and I was GMing, and my wife is a very creative player, and I mean that in the best way possible, but as a GM, sometimes it's in the most frustrating ways possible, because she will find ways completely within the rules to do things that don't break my story, but I'm just like, I can't believe you thought of that, but the rules don't say you can't. And one of the best was, we had this fight going on, big old dog fight. There were these mysterious transforming fighter planes that our heroes had never seen before. Our player characters are trying to fend them off. Raina's character is one of the aliens. She's in an alien mech. And she's like, we've shot all of this squadron down. I want to take one back. I'm like, okay, I that seems like a good idea. She's like, I want to kick a hole in it and drag it back to the ship. I'm like, oh, well,
okay.
You want to do what? She's like, I want my mech to kick a hole in the other mech. to disable
Why?
It.
Oh, okay.
So I'm like, well, so I like look at the charts, and sure enough, like if you like did a really well placed kick, you could like disable the entire power system on this mech. And I'm like, okay, but you'd have to have insane luck to pull this off. And she's like, okay, she shows and like pulls up her hand-to-hand stats, which factor into how you can pilot a mecha in hand-to-hand. And she's like, all right, we're gonna try this. Rolls. Natural 20. I stare at the dice. I stare at this die and this 20. And I look, and both my wife and all the other players are excitedly looking at me. And I'm just like, Restel kicks the unknown Valkyrie right through the center and wears it like a boot. I hope you're... and then, but not to be one-upped, that actual session ended with a cliffhanger. And I wanted to give everyone the full experience, so as our heroes return to their mothership, a huge blast of light surges past their home base, and they look out, and from the dark side of the moon, a super dimension-class battleship, like the giant Macross-sized ships, the main ships from the Macross universe, comes out from behind the dark side of the moon. And to really sell that this is a broken video transmission, I had it hidden, I pull out one of those Star Wars Clone Trooper voice changer helmets, and I put it on, and I read the entire, like, encoded radio message through this staticizing filter.
Oh my gosh.
And all of my players were like, God damn it. God damn it. And that was the cliffhanger I left them on. I'm a fun DM. I always overdo it with stuff like that.
I always try to, like... I always try to think of, like, what the best possible thing I could do in that moment as a player is. And so my friends and I were playing a game called Chill. It's a horror themed D20 game where you are like hunting the supernatural, and you're not supposed to let, you know, most people, the regular like people, know that you're hunting ghosts and stuff. So of course my character is this super cheerful, optimistic people person truck driver who loves ghost adventures. And so he's constantly carrying with him the dumb little like pseudo like ghost hunting stuff on his person. And there was a time we were in a city, and like things were getting like destroyed, people were dying, and the police are like, okay, we need to arrest you. So they come and arrest my character, and we're all like, what? Because like obviously I hadn't murdered anybody, but they're like, no, we saw you on like the security tape of these buildings, and you have to come to jail with us now. And so I'm like, okay, because the trick was, you know, I will happily sit in jail because I am safe there. Whatever it is out there that is pretending to be me and murdering people can't murder me because I'm sitting safe in jail.
I mean...
So I literally just, like, sat there for most of that episode while my other teammates, like, found the doppelganger and, like, killed it. And then afterwards, they come and get me, and I'm just like, sup? Been having a long nap, ate a lot of Skittles. Let's roll. It was very fun.
That's pretty great.
I mean,
it's so weird. Like, my role-playing sessions as an adult have been way tamer than they were when I was younger, only because I'm more selective about who I play with. Usually I'm the problem at the table these days. as you both have GM'd me just walking in and opening fire on people.
Yep.
But, like, when I was younger, like, you know, you'd always end up, like, at games, like, you know, trying to find people to play with when I was younger. Like, I always ended up in games where, like, I knew, like, half the people there, but not the other half. And, like, this one time, like, this guy Joel, who I went to high school with, we were in high school at the time, was running a D&D second ed campaign, and he asked for, you know, yes, if I wanted to play, and I was like, yes, of course I want to play, because I want to play always. I don't want to ever not be playing. You just can't, you know, feed yourself if you don't stop. But so I was playing, and one of the other players in the campaign was this guy Matthias, who I'd never met before. And the only reason I remember his name is because I never saw him again after this session. I remember his name is Matthias because he was the first human being I ever met who was named Matthias. Like, yeah. Anyways, I remember him for very specific reasons, though. This was a group of probably like 6 or 7 of us who were playing this game, and Joel was jamming. And I was probably playing a rogue because that's what I defaulted to back in the day. In second ed, I played thieves a lot. Thieves and bards. I don't remember if I was playing a thief or a bard. They were both under the rogue category in second ed. I'm old. I used to know how Thaco works, but I've forgotten. That's not a joke. I've forgotten like 90% of the rules from second ed. So even though it's the D&D I played, the AD&D that I played the most, I don't remember a lot of it. But because, you know, rules were always there for me to role play. Like, they were the structure that I could then make a character in and play them. And I cared way more about playing the character than I cared about, like, numbers. Numbers were the thing that facilitated it. Anyways, we were playing this campaign. Like, I don't even remember what we were doing. We were doing something normal, but we were in a town. And Matthias just announces, "I see a fountain." We all kind of looked puzzled. The GM just, Joel's like, "What?" And Matthias repeated, "I see a fountain." He's, no, you don't. There's no fountain. I want to look in the fountain. There is no fountain. I'm going to reach my hand into the fountain. There's no fountain. You are reaching your hand into the air. There is nothing there. I want to see if there's any gold in the fountain. There is no fountain. What are you talking about? Am I getting wet from the fountain? It's like, he just, like. And this is a guy who had played D&D before, apparently. Like, had many times. And just, whoever had GM'd for him before, apparently must have let him just get away with shit. Because we're all, and all of us are just kind of staring at this whole moment. Of like, well, we're gonna go into the tavern to meet the person we're supposed to be here to meet. Is there gold in the fountain? There is no fountain.
Wow.
I wonder what happened to that guy.
I don't
meet all kinds playing RPGs.
Yeah.
Oh boy. You guys got anything else?
I did think of one more that I really did enjoy. A few years back, I caught up with an old high school friend of mine, one of the few people from high school who I still stayed in contact with, and she wanted to run a, like, World of Darkness we were running, and she And we ran into, like, this group of werewolves, and we're playing, like, relatively, like, normal-ish people, not very well prepared for combat. Well, our attacks are doing next to no good. Something's not working. Well, what it was is that all of us were out of... I had never played before, most of us had never played before, and my friend who was running it was out of practice and couldn't remember what we were supposed to roll properly, so we weren't rolling enough damage. But she didn't want the fight to end too quickly, and the damage the werewolves were supposed to deal with, like, their claws and fangs would have ended the fight lickety-split. So to try to make up for that, she had them punch. So we fought the infamous pack of punch wolves. They're like werewolves, but they only punch people.
That's great.
It was amazing. Punch wolf is out there.
I feel like there are easier ways to get around that. Just, like, pretend that the werewolves are weaker or something. You know what I mean? And then use punch
that was
damage
her solution. Was punch wolves.
I mean, it's punch wolves is funnier, but I'm just saying, like, you could just, like, use punch damage while saying that they're attacking with their claws. You know what I mean? Like,
too late. It's punch wolf time.
Dear Lord.
I mean, it's just great the kinds of things that you can bring into a D&D game. One of the games I'm part of right now that's been on hiatus because our GM was moving is a... it's set in one of the worlds from Magic the Gathering, which is real neat. But, like, our party is full of weirdos, which is great, because I'm so used to, like, a bunch of, like, half-elves, you know? So I'm, like, a tabaxi. I'm this tiny tabaxi thief. We've got... oh, crap. What are they called? The bird people. We've got one of them. I'll quick look it up. We've got gnome. We've got a gnome bard, a goblin wizard, a giant construct. And I think one of my favorite concepts for a character, which is 10 kobolds that exist in a pocket dimension. Each one is a different class. And there's only ever one out of the pocket dimension at one time. But as soon as it falls asleep or unconscious, a different one pops out and you never know which one you're going to get. So if you had the fighter and they went unconscious, you could suddenly get the cleric.
That's and too good.
That's too it's good. Like the best thing I've ever heard of. It's great.
Well, we have been going for a while. And
I feel like it was a good one, though.
Yeah. No, it's... I hate to call things short, but this is a long episode and we don't even have a mailbag. So we should probably move on to the Vomit Head Steve Challenge.
Indeed.
The Vomit Head Steve Challenge, for those who are unaware, is the part of the show where every episode I read a line from a book. And the challenge to you, the listener, is to guess what book it is. If you guess correctly, you get included in the Hall of Awesome. The benefits of the Hall of Awesome are as follows. 1, we put your name on the website. 2, I'll say your name on the show. 3, no, nothing. I got nothing else. So, the current members of the Hall of Awesome are as follows. Arkhamite, Zero, Ren and Senti, Cheesy McDammy, Krista, Slitherity, Shameless Otaku, The Random Ramblings Man, Corfan, Capito, Chris Graham, Lily Source, Paper Godzilla, Cavsy, The Minnesota Librarian, Sean Orange, Keith Shizuo, Sakura Sunset, Joel Kreisman, Patrick Delahanty, and Wonderland Hearts. And I've been reading the same book for a while, so I'm going to pull that out now. And here is your line off of the random page I opened. So each side was aware that the other was also making its way towards the cave in the mountains. and they both knew that whoever got there first would have the advantage. If you know what book that's from, go to nerdandtie.com/contact, click on the Formy form, fill it out, and tell us. Or if you want to reach out to us for any other reason, that's also the place to go. Or if you want to have your voice on the show, like you were here or something, even though you're not, you can leave us a voicemail at area code 414-375-0480. Yes.
Come tell us your D&D stories.
Share them with us.
Yeah, we would love to hear your best gaming stories. And yeah.
And on that note, it's been a lovely episode of Nerd and Tie with myself, Ken Brock.
I'm Trey Dorn.
And I'm Nick Izumi.
And remember, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, on Stitcher, on Spotify, and pretty much anywhere else that podcasts are available or that can take an RSS feed. And you can always find that at nerdandtie.com. You can also follow us on social media at nerdandtie on Twitter, nerdandtie.tumblr.com, and facebook.com/nerdandtie. Now remember, you can support the show by either sponsoring episodes that found on the sponsor our shows link on nerdandtie.com, or you can contribute to our legal fund at gofundme.com/nerdandtie, or you can contribute to us individually. I've got a Patreon at patreon.com/TREGORN. Nick's got a Patreon at patreon.com/NickIzumi. Gen has an Etsy shop or whatever stuff. Lost a Lot Dude Designs. Go find it. Buy stuff. She makes neat things that you can have for yourself, for your life. You should do it. And with that, remember to look forward, look onwards, be one with the stars until you go too deep, gazing deep into the abyss, becoming one with the darkness, in which you then open one of your many mouths that sings the song that ends the world. Or not.
I mean, sure. Why not?
Say your catchphrase, Nick.
Keep on spocking. In the free world.
See, it's play on words. There's a song, you see.
It goes keep on rocking in the free world. Yeah. See, it's very clever.
It's a Star Trek reference.
It's better than Southern Man, which, I mean, I guess you could do like Klingon Man, but I don't really know how that would work.
Yeah, I don't. It wouldn't work.
Could sell me a log.
Sound the alarm.
I know, but it sounds like sell me a log, and I'm just like, I'd love to buy a log.
Why would you buy a log?